Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Stefan Kanfer, whose latest book is Tough Without a Gun, The Life and Extraordinary Afterlife of Humphrey Bogart. Stefan Kanfer is the author of several other books, including biographies. Maybe reappraisal is a better word than biographies, because there have been other biographies of Marlon Brando, Lucille Ball, and Harpo Marx, A History of Yiddish Theater, and the story of the De Beers Diamond Company as well, two novels. For many years, an editor at Time magazine and contributing editor at City Journal in New York. Stefan Kanfer, we spoke about your book on Brando.
Right.
After that, what brought you to Bogart?
There's a French critic named André Bazin, who was a big deal in his time, mostly in the 60s and 70s, and he contrasted the two actors. And after I had done Brando, and I was wondering what to do next, I read what Bazin had said. He said that with Marlon Brando, you never knew what you were going to get. And I know this is true because I spoke to John Huston about it, and he said, in Reflections of a Golden Eye, he asked Elizabeth Taylor and Brando to do 15 different takes. He said, with Elizabeth Taylor, who after all had been in film since the age of 16, exactly the same. 15 exactly the same pauses, same stresses, everything. Brando, 15 totally different takes. It was as if there were 15 different actors. And he said the difference between Brando and Bogart is that with Brando you never knew what you were going to get, and with Bogart you always knew what you were going to get. That interested me a lot. So I began to explore the movies and see how right he was and why he was right.
And at what point did you begin to realize that the book would be not just about the life of Bogart, but what happened after he died?
That was almost immediate because, after all, Bogart died in 1957, at the age of 57. And if he's with us now, it's because of this powerful influence he had, not on other actors, but on American life. What did he have that made people go back to him? And now it's over 50 years. Why are they still interested in Bogart? I spoke the other night. There were 400 people. And I know it's not me. I think it's because there is a powerful influence and a powerful feeling that something has gone out of American life, or at least gone out of American cinema, which involves the male lead. It's just so different now that they miss him.
There have been other actors who aren't classically handsome, though Bogart in his early years was not an ugly man at all. There have been other actors who came up late, like Bogart came up late, who spent years in the trenches before becoming stars. But still, there's something about this guy that is maintained. You know, the guy only made, what, three color films?
Yes, but of course he made thousands of black and white films. And, you know, I don't think, actually, that's a good point. I don't think he would have been a star if he had started in Technicolor. Because, you know, John Huston again said, if you met Bogart on the street, he was 5'8", probably more closer to 5'7". Not a big guy, thin, intelligent looking, but hardly the star. But he said when he got into those Warner Brothers noir movies, they knew how to light him. And suddenly, because the eyes and the eyebrows and the mouth were in the right position, and because he had that stiff upper lip and that kind of way of talking, which was almost musical, that he became heroic. And I think we took that image with us when he went into color, but had it been that way from the start, no, I don't think it would have happened.
Well, your introduction to the book talks about the shift in actors, that movie actors up until the rise of the method, they always seemed to give a certain kind of performance that allowed people to mimic them. It allowed for impressionists to take off on them. It allowed for cartoons to be about them as well, which you wouldn't get today. Your thought is that it has to do with the fact that a lot of these people began in radio.
Yes, it's interesting to note that there was something called the Lux Radio Theater, and they were all on it, you know, Gary Cooper and Cary Grant and Humphrey Bogart. Nobody felt ashamed to be on radio. That was the big medium in those days. But they had voices of a different kind. It sort of enabled them to present themselves without the picture. And so you really had to work on your voice. And that's why you have that Cary Grant kind of, you know, that sort of thing that was invented by Cary Grant. He began as a Cockney. That diction is something no one else did. He just talked like Cary Grant. And Bogart had his way, and, you know, Cagney with "you dirty rat." All these impressions that were later mimicked were done because these people knew that they had to have a distinctive vocal quality, and they took it with them into the visual.
And Bogart had kind of a lisp.
although there are many, many stories about it. The real truth is that when he was in the Navy, he joined it when he was 17 after having been kicked out of prep school, and he was a child of very privileged people, or else how would you get through with a name like Humphrey? He was guarding a prisoner who whacked him with a pair of handcuffs and tore up his upper lip rather badly. And so he had that kind of strange way of talking. It's not so much a lisp, it's just kind of a stiff way of delivery. And so he had to make his voice more musical. And if you'll see in Casablanca, it doesn't amount to a hill of beans in this crazy world, all those lines that came around and became immortal, "Here's looking at you, kid," were done because of that almost defensive quality he had because of his disability.
Stephen Kampfer, there are so many biographies, memoirs. How many biographies did you read before you even sat down and thought about what you were going to do?
There are probably 10, some of them a little more than cloth-bound gossip columns, and I don't do that, although there's a little bit about some of his girlfriends and his wives. But when I got to it, as you say, the important part really is the life in the afterlife and the kind of character that he was and the success that he had, because he seemed to crystallize something was going on in American life wherever he had a big movie. For example, in the real classic noir movie, The Maltese Falcon, it happened just when he was 42. It's a little late to become a star, but in those days, everybody was old. Admiral Nimitz, who was leading the Navy, was old. General MacArthur was old. President Roosevelt was old. So he didn't seem, in comparison, to be that old. That was the maturity of that period. Since the young men had all gone, or were about to go, overseas, he could be a movie star that people could identify with. Later on with Casablanca, he was the indifferent isolationist guy who was mostly interested in booze and in gambling. And then suddenly he realized rather late that he would have to sacrifice the love of his life and go off and fight the war. This was America. It abandoned its isolationist policy and was going to fight the fascists.
When you talk about he, I mean, we're talking about screenplays, we're talking about directors, and we're talking about casting directors in particular. So is it necessarily Bogart per se, or is it a casting person putting together the right role with the right person?
Well, let's take Maltese Falcon. That was really written with George Raft in mind. And George Raft said, "I want to be in an important picture. This is not an important picture. It's been made twice before," which was true. And John Huston was 32 years old and a new director, and who needs this? And so he walked off, and the casting director had nothing to do with it. Jack Warner said, "Okay, well, let this guy do what we want and bring in this, what's his name? Bogart? Okay, we'll do that." And it turned out to be a resounding success. With Casablanca, despite all the rumors that Ronald Reagan was going to be in others, it really was always written with Bogart in mind. And it was Ingrid Bergman that was the surprise. After that, there was kind of a Bogart character. So most of the time, the movies were written with him in mind. It was not an accident. No casting director said, "Let's see, who could we use for this?" They knew it was a Bogart movie. There are exceptions later on in his career, like The Caine Mutiny, which was written with nobody in mind because it was a novel, and then Lloyd Nolan played it on Broadway. And then finally, Bogart wanted so badly to show that he had some range, and so he took a salary cut to be in it.
When he first came in, he was a wastrel. Nobody knew what to do with him. He didn't know what to do with himself. He kind of stumbles into acting via being a stage manager and being an understudy. And he's the guy who always said, "Tennis anyone," to get everybody off stage for the next scene.
That's right. He was really a pretty boy at that point. And pictures of that period show him as what used to be called in those days a sprig. And the reason they had somebody say "tennis anyone" or "tea" or whatever was that they had to get everybody off stage so they could change the scenery. So in those days, you could also hide a bad actor, which he was originally. I mean, his first role, he played a Japanese butler. You can imagine what that was like. Everybody was embarrassed for him. But, you know, you learn. He was in almost 20 plays on Broadway, and after a while he began to learn how to act, how not to be embarrassed, then finally how to impersonate somebody, and how to be pretty damn good. And toward the end of his career on Broadway, a producer said, "You know, there's something about Bogart. Silence seems to cling to him. People look at him. Let's try him out as a heavy." And he played a role called Duke Mantee in The Petrified Forest that really changed theater and certainly changed his life, because he played a tough guy, a murderer, who kills Leslie Howard, who was, you know, a great friend of his and for whom he named his daughter. That kind of made people look at Bogart very differently. Wait a minute, this guy's got a sort of masculinity, a toughness, an aura of danger. At that point, having gone through a lot, including booze and a couple of wives, Bogart decided something early on that he had to do about his own life. He said there are only two kinds of characters who act, professionals and bums. And by God, he was going to be the former, not the latter.
Bogart, in front of a camera, I mean, people talk actually about Marilyn Monroe that way, that you could be in the set watching her do her thing, and everybody said, God, she's ghastly. And then they'd look at the rushes, and something exploded just on film. Was it kind of that way with Bogart?
Well, because he had had stage experience, there was more to him than that. But clearly he was meant to be a celluloid personality. And when he got on camera, I think he geared stuff down. He was an intelligent guy, and he knew to gear stuff down. I remember Walter Matthau once told me that he learned to act, because he'd been a stage actor, from Audrey Hepburn. He said he watched her making a movie, and it's kind of like Marilyn Monroe in a way. He said she didn't do anything. Dailies are going to be terrible. And it turned out that she had a wide range done with minimalist gestures. And the same thing is true with Bogart. He does not give you big gestures. He gives a small smile. He does a lot of rictus and funny things with his lips and with his voice. But he's the consummate cinema actor for that reason. Here's one of the things he was doing that Spencer Tracy also did. He was listening. And you watch him opposite other actors. They loved him because he paid attention. He didn't say, oh, this is about me. Well, I'm not talking now, so I'll just let him go. No, he was always really in the moment. And I think that kind of respect that he got made the set a happy one, as it was with Maltese Falcon. Mary Esther loved him because he really paid attention to her strangeness. And it was true in Casablanca and all the other movies.
There were difficulties in the late 30s with Warner Brothers in terms of movies they were going to put him in and his response to being thrown in those movies. A movie that you don't mention, but insofar as I knew, that was the movie that they punished him with, was something, piece of garbage, called The Return of Dr. X.
There are all kinds of movies like that. The Clitterhouse, and there are a lot of other movies that were almost punishments for him. He was in a Western, you know, and he wasn't tall. They gave him high heels, and he looks terrible in a mustache. Every time you see him in a mustache, you know, you can turn to another channel because it's not going to be any good. That's the way Jack Warner was. Jack Warner had a sort of mild contempt for actors and a major contempt for writers, whom he called schmucks with Underwoods. You know, he was not going to be pushed around by any actor. And every time Bogart gave him any trouble, he put him into some bad movie, up to a point. Then when he became a star, he couldn't do that anymore.
Bogart also was involved in politics. During the 30s, he didn't hang out with communists or anything, but he was a Roosevelt liberal, right?
He was a Roosevelt liberal and didn't like to be pushed around. And when the House on American Activities came to town, he was among the real leaders, originally, in facing them down and saying, you know, you're not going to mess around in my town. And there are no communists here, or there are very few communists, and who cares anyway? It's none of your goddamn business. But when push came to shove, there were the unfriendly 19, and then it became the Hollywood 10 that everybody knows about. And Billy Wilder, being Billy Wilder, said, some of them are talented, the rest are just unfriendly. Eventually, they began to put on a very bad show before the cameras in the House of Modern Activities Committee, and Bogart got scared, and he thought, they're going to take me and use me, the communists are, and they were communists, and they actually lied to their lawyer, Bartley Crum, about it, and he withdrew. Paul Henried, for example, never spoke to him again, his co-star in Casablanca. Other people who said he was never the same afterward, which I think is nonsense. He was the same afterward. He just was not going to be taken advantage of. The truth is, if they had all stayed together and faced down HUAC, it would have been a lot better. But it was fragmented, and he was just one of the boys.
And the left in America, the Hollywood Ten, are kind of put in an exalted position. Obviously, whether they were communists or not is irrelevant now. We don't care. Their politics were their politics, and being socially on the left and putting out socially progressive movies.
They're hardly, I mean, every now and then they snuck in a line or something like that. I mean, the whole nonsense of the communists taking over the industry when you had Harry Conan and Jack Warner as watchdogs. I mean, it was really a terrible period. I wrote a book about it called A Journal of the Plague Years. It was a horrible time. It was one that I think Bogart could have been tougher on.
You do make the point that the Hollywood 19 or 10, that they kind of overreached in their decision-making, and that alienated people.
Yeah, I think there was John Howard Lawson, who really was kind of the commissar there, began calling House of Activities investigator's name was Stripling, Mr. Quisling, said it was stupid. They shouldn't have done that. They also should not have lied to their lawyer. They also should have taken the Fifth Amendment and then the First Amendment. You know, they have certainly had a right to free speech. It was manipulated very badly. It was a melodrama, and it should really have been presented to the American public in a different manner. But who knew, you know?
And it ended eventually in the early 60s anyway.
Well, another gutsy actor named Kirk Douglas said, Dalton Trumbo is going to get credit on my film. I don't care what anybody says. And did on Spartacus, and that sort of ended it.
And nobody gives Douglas credit for that, I don't think.
No, but I do.
Stephen Kamfer, if we're going to talk about the essential Bogart, I wrote down a list of films. I picked out the Roaring Twenties just because it's emblematic of that era.
And everybody's in it, and it's fun.
Then Maltese Falcon, Casablanca, To Have and Have Not, Big Sleep, Treasure of the Sierra Madre, African Queen, and Caine Mutiny. And there's one other one. And the reason I'm mentioning this separately, because I interviewed Eddie Muller, who's an expert on noir, and he said the greatest noir film in his mind is a movie called In a Lonely Place.
Well, the reason In a Lonely Place is beloved, I suspect, by him and others, is that Bogart plays a screenwriter in it. So naturally, every screenwriter who's ever had a bad time connects with this. Gloria Graham was in it, and she, to me, is just the essential noir actress. It's a terrific movie. In it, Bogart plays an almost psychopathic person who's accused of murder, and actually he's innocent of it, but he's wrecked in his own life and that of the woman who loved him. I think it's a writer's movie. I don't think it's a viewer's movie. If you're not connected to the industry, I don't think you'd find it as satisfactory as the others you've mentioned.
And the others you would agree are the quintessential?
Well, the reason that I love, it's funny, not all of them made money. Like, The Treasure of the Sierra Madre never made any money until much later because it has no romance. There's no women in it. It's a terrific movie, and it's the one, you know, you don't have to show you no stinking badges. It's the one you don't remember Bogart's line. You remember Alfonso Bedoya's line in it. Yes, that's a quintessential Bogart, and I think one of the great successes was The Late Love One, The African Queen, because no one expected that to take off the way it did. And Alexander Korda, a very big deal in England, said to John Huston, it's about two old people going down in a river in a raft. You'll lose a fortune. Well, they made a fortune, and Bogart got his one and only Academy Award because of it.
And then, of course, there's Beat the Devil, one of the great flops of all time.
It's funny about that, because Bogart produced it and hated it. He said, only phonies think it's funny. But there's this guy who somehow seems to be in the epicenter of whatever's going on. Though he hated it, it was Capote's first real attempt at a full script. He was a new guy at that point. Originally, Bogart hated him. Then they hand-wrestled, and Capote was a tough little guy. He won, and then they wrestled sort of on the floor, and he pushed Bogart down and cracked his ankle, and then Bogart learned to kind of like this guy and admire him. Yes, it was a flop, but at the same time, it went on and on and on. Now it's made money through the years, and it's a kind of legendary movie. When I saw it the first time, I couldn't figure it out. I just knew what was going on. You need more time to take a look and see what's going on. I still don't think it's a great movie, but it's so weird having, you know, Peter Lorre named O'Hara, things like that, that you know the whole thing is a put-on.
Before we go on to the extraordinary afterlife of Bogart, in your research through reading all of these books and then your original interviews, Stephen Kamfer, what do you think you learned that you really didn't know before? What conclusions did you draw that came directly out of your research?
Well, the one thing I think was obvious, and it's not just with him, there's certain other actors whose private life and public life you can see on the screen. There's something about Bogart's suffering. He had a couple of bad marriages, one terrible marriage, a wife who even stabbed him in the back. And the lines were there in the face, and his father died broke after having a pretty good career as a surgeon, and the mother was America's best-known illustrator. So there was plenty of money there when he was growing up, but it all got lost. He paid off every dime. It's the kind of guy he was. And he used to tell the makeup director, I don't want to take these lines out. You leave those lines in. I worked very hard for them. Unfortunately, some of those lines came from booze and cigarettes, and the combination killed him. And when I watch him on screen smoking, I want to reach into the screen. Don't you know what you're doing to yourself? But the private life and the public life I did find interesting in the research, and I also thought that what he was as a friend who sort of cultivated writers rather than actors, but who would never let a charitable act be seen. He'd turn down a guy, down his luck, and then privately send a check. That kind of private man, I think, is a very interesting thing when you contrast it to, say, Rick in Casablanca. It's very close to what Bogart really was.
He fought the Hollywood system, but so did Betty Davis, so did many others. Was it common for most of the stars to fight in the same way?
I think you had to. I remember one talking to Betty Davis, and she said the one thing she knew was that she'd have to drive herself nuts. She said, I knew I would have a nervous breakdown, but I would get a nomination for the Academy Award. They had to do this. I think the fight was constant, as it is in all of show business. I mean, if you don't choose the right properties, after a while, you become an unknown. This is what happened to George Reft. After the Maltese Falcon, he made one picture for Warners and then went on the down escalator, because he wasn't very good about choosing scripts.
In those days, they didn't have much choice, or did they?
Well, it was pretty much a factory until you proved yourself. After you proved yourself a star and you were pretty good and had a public following, then the studio was less likely to push you around.
And Bogart made a lot of bad choices in the last 10 years of his life.
He did. In fact, he was sustained largely by the pictures that you mentioned. And fortunately, he had John Huston at his side. And Huston really loved them. These are two guys very much alike. I mean, they didn't look alike. You know, Huston was one of these perpetual optimist, don't worry, it'll all be fine, you know, as opposed to Bogart, who worried about everything. But they were men's men. They liked to drink. They liked to smoke. They liked to talk until late hours. That's what saved Bogart. He made a lot of choices. And at the end, you know, he didn't feel well. He was really dying when he was the very last movie he made called The Harder They Fall. It was about the corruption of the boxing business. Did you realize that boxing was corrupt? I mean, it's, you know, this film should never have been made had he felt better, or he wouldn't have made them.
You mentioned a couple of films in there that he might have made had he lived, because he was planning them. How long do you think his career would have gone on? Because unlike Cooper or Gable, who died at the point when their career would have faded, as opposed to, say, Grant or Cagney, who retired, though Cagney later briefly unretired, they all around 60, 61, 62, they pretty much were gone if they didn't die.
No, I think that's true. I would imagine Bogart, who aged badly anyway, would probably not have had many more films of any consequence. Although you never know this. That's what I said there. When you find something that is exactly right for you, like The African Queen, you suddenly realize, hey, this guy could do comedy. After all those years, he couldn't do comedy. He might have found something to do, even for a small role. For example, when he plays Captain Queeg and has the breakdown, I could tell you, I've seen that a lot. And you look at it from the side, you think you're seeing Frost Nixon. It's absolutely amazing how he predicted that kind of paranoid figure before he occurred on the American scene. So there might have been something, but surely he would not have been a superstar, no, no.
Then he died, and a lot of these folks that we've talked about died. But a lot of these guys, they went away, and we remember them as actors, stars of the past. Something about Bogart is different.
Well, he's Mr. Cool. When Albert Camus got the Nobel Prize, he was 44, and he was very flattered when people said, you know, with the trench coat and the cigarette, you kind of remind me of Bogart. He would smile. He thought that was great. Because Bogart seemed to be the quintessential existentialist. That's still with us. There's that. I think it's also his attitude toward women. I can take him or leave him. That was kind of very appealing to college kids. And after his death at the Brattle Theater in Harvard, that became kind of emblematic of what they wanted to be. And also, I think Bogart is irreplaceable because there's no sort of middle-aged, ur-masculine hero in cinema today. Most of the people that we see as leading men are what are called boy-men, boy men. There's nothing to take away from DiCaprio. He's a very good actor, or you know, Tobey Maguire, people like that. But they're really not mature heroes. And there's something in us that wants that still. There's some American appetite for that, and we can't find it. You can find a Clooney who does a very good light kind of comedy and can be serious as well, but it's not that half New York, half Hollywood noir personality. I don't think that's possible to even invent now. It's part of the past.
The other aspect is that unlike someone, man's man, quote-unquote, like John Wayne, you know, there's a political element to who likes him and who doesn't like him. I've never seen any in terms of Bogart, and if it is one, it's something that the left seems to appreciate more than the right.
I think it's because of the real independence. You know, John Wayne, it isn't just the right wing. I mean, it's so much testosterone. It's that drawling and the gait. It's, oh, come on, John. You know, after all, but you don't feel that Bogart is overacting. In fact, if anything, he seems to be pulled in. And I think that quality of let some of it hang out probably is a left thing. I mean, you know, you don't want to just display your masculinity as if it were an egg you were breaking into a frying pan. You have to withhold something. If that's political, that's what it is, a kind of sensitivity to others, but not putting your heart on your sleeve and displaying everything.
What I'm catching here is there's a genuineness there that goes through all of his work, a similarity that goes through all of his work that's different than what actors do today, and it's a bizarre combination that we just simply don't see today.
W.H. Auden, the poet, wrote about this, and Lionel Trilling wrote about the difference between sincerity and authenticity. You can be sincere as hell and be a really terrible actor, or you can do what they say. Once you learn to fake sincerity, you don't have to worry about anything else. But authenticity is something else entirely, and that's something that Bogart always brought with him, was that authenticity. If he was in a role, whether he was a screenwriter or a gold miner or the owner of a gambling casino, you believed it, because there was something authentic about him when he stepped onto that screen.
If you were to pick one Bogart movie that you would like above all the others?
Well, I just like The Treasure of the Sierra Madre because I think he had a chance to really show that he could be a really disagreeable individual and you still couldn't keep your eyes off him. That film is, after all, John Huston's love poem to his father. It's not about Bogart. You know, the celebrated scene in which Walter Huston jumps up and down and makes fun of everybody and dances and everything, and he overacted so badly that everybody's eyes were averted. And Bogart said, one, Huston's bad enough, two are murdered. And they waited for what John would say to his father after this overacting, and he was sitting up there on a boom, and Walter Huston looked up and said, well, what'd you think, son? And John Huston said, a little too much Walter Huston, Dad. So with all the hamminess around him, I think Bogart's tight-lipped presence was just a wonderful thing to watch.
Stephen Kamfer, you were the first bylined film critic for Time magazine. How did you get that role?
There was a guy named John McPhee who went to the New Yorker, and there was a big hole on the staff, and they tried several people as show business writer, and I tried out, and I got it. And I stayed there about a year, year and a half, 2 years maybe, and the film critic, Brad Dara, who had followed James Agee, left to get divorced and never came back, so I inherited his role, and I kept it for 5 years. I was seeing 9 movies a week, and I said, I got to dry out. I can't do this anymore, and I'd rather write about people who make the movies but not essay each film as it comes out. So I left that.
And today these news magazines are dying. Do you think they'll completely fade away?
I do. I think what's going to happen is the Internet will take over. I mean, we're seeing a whole revolution in front of our eyes. Who reads newspapers anymore? I mean, I think my kids hardly read them. I have to have paper. I don't want to see television in the morning or the Internet in the morning. I want to see a paper. But I think that generation is going, and I don't think in the future that there'd be a big chance for Time or Newsweek. I don't think there's any room in the jungle for those animals now, alas. But there's room on the Internet for all of them.
Yet at the same time, I think there is room, and I'm not sure why, for Vanity Fair and The New Yorker and The Atlantic Monthly.
It's a different kind of magazine. You know, I think it's much more a portrait of American life, and there's always something special in each one of those magazines, the way there couldn't be in Time and Newsweek, because allegedly they were about what was going on for that week.
So the fact that we can see 15 different newspapers in 5 minutes or in a half hour every day online, and of course we've got places like Huffington Post and other portals to different areas.
That's true, and, you know, the attention of young America is so fragmented now with texting and iPods and all the rest of it. You know, it's one of these things where you look and you say, what position do films have in American life? They certainly are no longer central, the way Time is no longer central. Things have changed enormously, and we miss them. You know, I don't know that you miss Time magazine that much, nor do I, but I think you miss the idea that everybody went to, let's say, Sunset Boulevard, saw it the same month, went to school, discussed it. You know, I'm sure that happened with The Wizard of Oz, certainly with Disney. And that sort of stopped after the big blockbuster movies of the 70s and 80s. I think when something like The King's Speech comes along, which is a grown-up movie, people will discuss it, but not in the way they used to.
Well, the other thing is the great, you know, water cooler TV shows like Sopranos or Mad Men aren't watched by that many people.
No, they're not. It's a very different kind of thing. And, you know, there are a lot of people who don't have HBO, so that it's not that big a thing in their lives.
You know, in talking about films today, we've seen something strange this winter, which is the triumph of the intelligent film. Had there been 5 nominees rather than 10 for the Oscars, all 5 of them made at least $90 million.
My belief is that, you know, you can only eat cotton candy so long, then you have to have some spinach or some steak or some chicken or some fish. And that's what's happened. There's no protein in these movies. And these kids have gone for 2 decades or more. The mall rats have taken over. They buy the movies. Naturally, it's understandable. You're 18, 19, 20 years old. You want to see somebody your own age up there on the screen. So you have Knocked Up, or you have this Legally Blonde 58 or whatever. You can't keep going that way. Eventually, somebody's going to come with some nourishment. King's Speech is a feel-good movie. It's good, but it's a feel-good movie. But it's about grown-ups, and something is at stake there. It isn't just a kid. I think that's what's going to happen. The boomers are going from 50 to 60, and they want to see somebody their own age on screen. They want to also see some vital problems. They don't want to just see teenagers in trouble. So I think you can look forward to grown-up movies, a great deal more of them, mature movies. Whether they become huge moneymakers is another story.
Both Black Swan and Social Network had younger actors, but they were serious films as well.
They were, and I could argue about Social Network's value, because I could argue about the value of Facebook, but you can't argue about the filmmaking. It's a very good piece of cinema, and it has craft, and that, you know, gets us back to Bogart. I mean, if you respect craft and you see actors who really know their craft, that's what endures. The posturing, the artsy stuff goes. But when you have somebody really, like John Huston, who knows how to make a movie, and it's 20, 30 years, even 40 or 50 years later, you sit there at the set and you say, this is terrific. I can watch this for an hour and a half and not be bored for a second.
Stephen Camphor, 2 recent essays I'd like to talk about. One is The Gribbonizing Finn. Huck Finn has been rewritten by, what's his name, Gribbon, and you call it postmodern censorship. I'm in agreement with you, and I also understand why people would freak out. I'm not sure what the answer is, except that censorship is wrong.
I think that you have to open it all up. First of all, it's an American classic. Secondly, when Mark Twain used the N-word, it was to show, first of all, probably the most liberal writer of the 19th century, to show people how terrible black life was at that point. His uncle had slaves. He grew up on a farm with slaves, and he was horrified at this. He was offended. And he talked about how you could be really friends with a black kid until a certain age, and then you get pulled apart. And he wanted to give a portrait of that life. If you feel that this is offensive to black children, then it's your job to teach them, if you're a teacher, the context in which this book was written and the moral position of the author. I hate censorship of any kind anyway, so my back goes up immediately when I saw that. Even though I think the professor was well-intentioned, it's not the right thing to do, and it opens up a gate that I don't want to see opened.
The other essay is called Exile in Dogpatch, which is about how Al Capp is forgotten, and you claim that it's because he became a right-winger toward the end, and I would have gone with that. But then I suddenly remembered nobody remembers Walt Kelly either.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because that's my next essay. Because I do essays for City Journal. I light firecrackers in the back of the book, and I did it at time. And that's exactly what I want to point out, is that people have forgotten Walt Kelly, who was not only a genius, either comic genius, but with his fingers as well as with his mind. I mean, he could draw Senator McCarthy, and it would look like a polecat, but it also looked like Senator McCarthy, who would draw Lyndon Johnson, and it would look like a hound dog, but it would also look like Lyndon Johnson. He had a great ability to do that, and you're right, but I do think that if there's an anniversary of Walt Kelly, I think he will be acknowledged. There was an anniversary of Lil Abner and another one about Al Capp. It just went by the boards because nobody wants to discuss that, whereas when he was a liberal, you know, he was the darling of everybody.
But the people who were going to be doing the discussing were the people who came of age in the 60s.
True.
And they're the people who resent Al Capp.
It's true. It's true, because that's the only Al Capp they know.
Right.
They know the right winger. They don't know the guy who was really one of the great fighters against General Motors and a lot of the other things. But that was another part of his life. He was also pretty nuts at the end of his life.
You mention in Tough Without a Gun that Lauren Bacall sings in To Have and Have Not, and there was a rumor going around that
Andy Williams. It's not true. I mean, first of all, you know, she was in a musical much later on called Applause, which is sort of based on All About Eve, and she sang in that cloudy voice, but the voice is what made her.
Right.
I mean, that kind of sexy voice. She didn't have a great range, but she and Bogart certainly lit up the screen. First of all, they were in love. They really were, and it was a very hot romance. But the other part was the delivery. You know, you know how to whistle, don't you, Steve? Just put your lips together and blow. I mean, that sort of thing. In those days, that was a wow line. I mean, that really was a shocker that they got past the censors. So she was good at that sort of thing. But no, she didn't. Andy Williams did not sing for her.
Speaking of that, did Bogart ever have any comment about the way the code was enforced? The code was constantly preying on filmmakers. It must have preyed on Houston.
That was less sexual than it was political because, for example, in The Treasure of the Sierra Madre, there's a line about gold and greed, and it's the amount of labor that goes into it. Well, the word labor was such a turnoff in the censorship that they had to change the line, and this is how crazy Hollywood was in those days. I don't think Bogart was bothered by the sexual code because he really was a 19th century guy. I mean, he was born in 1899, but his parents were deep into that, and he grew up as a gentleman, even though he, you know, kicked away the traces and got kicked out of Andover and never went to college. He still was a very mannerly person who, you know, walked on the outside of the street with women, crossed the street with them in a certain way, tipped his hat, did all those things. So I don't think that he was out to beat the censor sexually at all. I think he was cool with that.
And in terms of usage of certain terms that later came into vogue, the F word, let's say, he wouldn't have used those in private.
No, not at all. He was very much, you know, he was a chess player. He liked Bach. He liked Debussy. He just didn't want the world to know that. That's all.
And how would he have felt about Don't Bogart That Joint?
Well, he and Houston did not, you know, they liked their alcohol. They were not druggies. I think Houston tried it a little bit. His father tried it and kind of liked it, but Houston didn't like it at all. And they liked the buzz. They liked to have a constant alcohol buzz. You know, usually at lunch, Bogart drank. If he was doing a scene, he wouldn't. But come 6 o'clock, he had to have his martini or his scotch.
Running through the biography is an awful lot of alcohol.
Yes.
I mean, these folks drank like fish compared to what we see today.
They came out of that tradition of the speakeasy. Because alcohol was forbidden, of course it was very desirable. And that was exactly Bogart's youth. So in the 30s, until Roosevelt canned that whole notion of prohibition, that's what they did. They went to speakeasies and drank and drank and drank. It became a habit. And the men particularly, it was a masculine thing to do, just as smoking was. And as I said, you can go on the screen and see into Have and Have Not, and particularly in The Big Sleep, which begins with two cigarettes in an ashtray and ends with two cigarettes in an ashtray. You see these people in a very different world from the one that we know today.
Stephan Kampfer, I think I know the answer to this, but what do you think about these ideas of using CGI to put a Bogart into a contemporary film?
Of course you know the answer to that. we hate the idea. First of all, I think there's an actor has his integrity and his time. The idea of taking him out of his time and putting him in another time is such a horrible concept. I remember a friend of mine was doing something in advertising having to do with the Marx Brothers. I said, you can't do that. And, of course, eventually he couldn't do it. These people belong on the screen. They don't belong in advertising. They don't belong in remakes. Get yourself another Bogart if you think you can. That's the way to do it.
Well, Stephan Kampfer, now you've finished this book and your next one?
Well, I got to tell you, I'm going to answer this the way Billy Wilder did. Billy Wilder was always asked after he finished his film, what's your next film going to be? And he would always give the same answer. He would say, it's about the human condition. So that's all I can tell you.
Have you started work on it?
Well, I have, but there's always the agent and there's always the publisher. So we'll have to see if we can come to an agreement.
Do you ever think about going back to fiction?
I have. I've written three novels. You mentioned two. I've written three, but only one of them was a Book of the Month Club selection. It was about gypsies and the Holocaust. I have thought about it. On the other hand, you know, if you're trying to make a living, it's not the easiest thing to do. Fiction doesn't sell that well.
And what exactly do you do for City Journal?
Largely feature stuff on either performances or people who made Broadway. I wrote a book, which is a collection of those essays, called The Voodoo That They Did So Well. And in it is a piece about Da Ponte, who was Mozart's collaborator, who wound up as a wholesale grocer and who was at Columbia University, a very strange, wonderful guy. who began as a Jew and then became a priest. And it's just it's a great story. And I did one on the Gershwins and one on Cole Porter and one on Richard Rodgers and so on. And so that's the sort of thing I like to do. And as you dug out of me, I'm going to do Walt Kelly next.
And are you still teaching?
I teach now and then. I think right now it's probably better for me not to, because I've got to get started on the new book. I do it when they ask me to. I don't go out and do it otherwise.
And finally, Stefan Kampfer, if we're looking at Bogart from the perspective of political and social context in 2011, what can we take away and why should we care?
I think that Bogart represents, for all of us, the way in which, say, Raymond Chandler presented him. Chandler had a hero named Philip Marlowe, who was played by Bogart in The Big Sleep, and he said, "Down these streets a man must go who is neither tarnished nor afraid." It's the kind of Knight Templar of our time. I think most men, and some women, would like to live like that, would like to be considered that way. That is, you can take a lot of battering, but eventually you are as incorrodible as a zinc bar. You are yourself. You play yourself. And I think it's very important to have that image before us, not of compromise, but of a genuine feeling that you can only go so far in your compromises, and then you've got to be yourself. It's a very important image. It's been with us forever, and I think Bogart just crystallized for his time and now for ours.
You've been listening to an interview with Stefan Kampfer, whose latest book is Tough Without a Gun, The Life and Extraordinary Afterlife of Humphrey Bogart. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.